Welcome to Better, Worse, or the Same. I am your host, Jason Meckenbier. Today on the show, we are going to go over a brief history of vaccination. Our guest is Dr. Monica Gandhi, who is a professor of medicine and associate division chief of the Division of HIV, Infectious Diseases, and Global Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. She also serves as the medical director for the Center for AIDS Research and the medical director of the HIV clinic at San Francisco General Hospital. It's March of 1718. Lady Mary Montagu found herself in a difficult situation. Her husband was being called back to London, and very soon the family would have to leave Constantinople. Lady Mary was concerned as there was an outbreak of illness at home, and while she and her husband were both immune, her children were not. Usually the procedure was done in the fall, however she had hastily arranged for it to be done this spring before they left. Without her husband's knowledge, Lady Mary continued. In a letter home the previous year, she describes a procedure. The old woman comes in with a nutshell, full of the matter of the best sort, and asks which vein you please have opened. She immediately rips open that you offer her with a large needle which gives no more pain than a common scratch, and puts into the vein as much matter as can lie upon the head of the needle, and after that binds up the little wound with a hollow bit of shell, and in this manner opens four or five veins. After coming back to England, Lady Mary was very influential in making the procedure commonplace. The method of conferring protection by transferring a small amount of infected material from an ill individual to a non-infected individual was called variolation, and while the practice was imperfect, it was vastly safer than natural infection. At the time, over 30% of the individuals who contracted smallpox died, which added up to over 400,000 annual deaths in Europe during the time of Lady Montagu. Compare that to 2% of the individuals who received the imperfect vaccine. This was the only method of protection until the middle of the 1700s, when a farmer, Benjamin Jesty, discovered that variolation with cowpox instead of smallpox conferred similar levels of protection without the risk of death. Edward Jenner independently came to a similar conclusion, and in 1796, he inoculated an 8-year-old boy, James Phipps. Our modern understanding of vaccination came about after Jenner published his findings and people moved away from inoculation with smallpox to inoculation with cowpox. Jenner called the procedure vaccine inoculation after the Latin word for cow, which is vacca. Variolation can thus be seen as a method of protection while waiting for a safer vaccination to be developed or discovered. While looking up the history of smallpox, I found an article by Drs. Monica Gandhi and George Rutherford, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine on September 8, 2020. In that article, they hypothesized that wearing masks could be a form of variolation that might reduce the severity of COVID-19 infection. They cite research on other viruses, animal studies with SARS-CoV-2 or coronavirus, as well as observational studies of disease spread among individuals as evidence supporting their hypothesis. As with many things surrounding the current pandemic, their article garnered much pushback and criticism. Our guest today is the author of that article, Dr. Monica Gandhi.
Perfect. Thank you so much for doing this. I'll admit I'm a little intimidated. You are the first person on my tiny little podcast with your own Wikipedia page.
Oh, well, yeah, but like someone put that up for me and I don't know. Okay, yeah, I even have to look at that and see if that's right.
You got to edit it. If you wanted to do a quick summary of your Wikipedia page, because a lot of the listeners here in Albuquerque don't know your work. They don't know exactly what you do. What would be like a 2 or 3 sentence synopsis of who you are and what you do and things like that?
So I am an infectious disease doctor and I have been at UCSF since 1996. And mostly what I do is HIV medicine. So I treat patients living with HIV and I do research on HIV. And because I'm interested in adherence to HIV medications, when the COVID pandemic happened, and because I'm an ID doctor, I pivoted some of my interests into prevention of COVID-19 and adherence to prevention measures. And that's where it came up. this idea of the masks and adhering to masks and what it takes to adhere to masks and different ways to think about masking as a preventative measure. So that's how it all ties in. And hopefully we'll get to this vaccine soon, but for right now, we do need to keep on wearing masks during this time. So that's why I'm interested in any research that convinces people about this public health intervention, because to this day, I'm still getting a lot of controversy around masking.
Yes, and that's how I found you, because I was looking at smallpox, and I found your article in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was a very interesting article, considering that you were talking about viral load and how, you know, maybe based on other diseases and based on, you know, what we've seen in animal studies, decreased viral load could potentially lead to a decrease disease severity with coronavirus.
Right. And that was the hypothesis that we put forth, which I have to say has been met with controversy, which is fine because I think anything should be debated in science. But really what it was is that we were looking at kind of the pandemic over time. And I was looking at all these strange reports of 95% asymptomatic rate in this setting and 99% asymptomatic. And then suddenly like everyone gets sick in this setting. And what were the factors that led to severity of illness? And beyond age and comorbidities, which have come out again and again as being led to more severe disease, there seemed to be something about the virus. And it seemed that people who were more crowded at the beginning, when healthcare workers weren't masking, when people were in lived environments and one person got sick and so their family member got sick, they were more likely to get sick. And so then I started looking in the literature, and that was true of measles, that was true of influenza, that measles, for example, people would get more sick if they were in this lived environment of people crowded together. And so what could we do to, you know, separate people from each other? And the physical barrier of a mask, along with social distancing, at least in multiple studies, seem to look like there's less severe disease if you have this either barrier of a mask or social distancing or both. And so then we put together all this kind of observations that places that have been masking have less severe disease than places that don't, and came up with this hypothesis. And then also looked in the background and looked at the literature about other viruses. And it seemed like many other viruses, the less of the viral dose you get in, the less sick you get. So putting it all together, we came up with this idea that one of the factors that make you more or less sick is how much virus you get in. We're actually calling it inoculum or dose instead of load, because we think of load as what you produce. So we think of the inoculum as what you get in, and put out this article in the New England Journal about masking, reducing the viral inoculum, and maybe that being a factor in making you less sick. And got into trouble for it, but that's okay.
It was kind of interesting because from my standpoint, it seemed like your hypothesis was very logical, and it didn't seem very controversial at all, really. But it was kind of amazing that the pushback, lots of pushback. Why do you think that there was that response? I mean, I was actually really kind of surprised that people, because nowhere in your article you mentioned we shouldn't wear masks. You highlighted the importance. Why do you think that people responded that way?
I think there were two streams of controversy. One is that wearing masks, period, is a controversial thing in the United States, not other countries, but because we had poor presidential leadership that didn't model mask wearing, it became a political thing. So I got a lot of kind of mail about how people aren't getting enough oxygen because I'm encouraging them to wear masks because I wrote a masking article. And that was unfortunate because that was a kind of stream of controversy that I felt badly about, but I could understand because what had happened in this country is that it became politicized. Then there were a couple of people who were concerned about the idea that masking, putting on a mask, would give someone too much of a sense of control and too much of kind of a self-protective efficacy for themselves. And I think it worried some epidemiologists actually that it would kind of message to the public, you can go out with a mask and you can be safe. Now, that's actually not what we were saying. And unfortunately, when people put out things in controversy now, they put it out in Twitter feeds or they do podcasts or they yell and they don't actually call up the person and say, is this what you meant? And so we didn't actually, unfortunately, there was no dialogue about it. And I didn't invite, I actually tried to invite the dialogue, but it wasn't, it seemed that people are so interested in just kind of polemics right now. So no one wants to have a dialogue with two scientists. They just want to put out polemics. So fine. So the polemical argument against this would be that you are encouraging people to think that masks are, give them too much protection, that they can go out in public, that they shouldn't stay at home, that they shouldn't just shelter in place. And you're giving people a false sense of security. And the problem and what really upset them, I think, is the word variolation. Because the word variolation, which we use deliberately, is definitely, in retrospect, a historical concept that is controversial in the sense that it was done. It was absolutely done. There was no vaccines. Why wouldn't we try to give people kind of a poor man's vaccine, which is a scab from a smallpox patient? But later, when there was a vaccine, it literally, in some areas, was declared illegal to variolate. So because of its history and the historical connotations of that word, I think that people, there were some visceral reactions to the phrase variolation. But we used it deliberately because we meant that if you get a less severe disease and it gives you immunity, and there's paper after paper now, 18, I've been counting them, on giving you immunity, even when you, that you can get immunity to COVID, even when you get mild or asymptomatic disease. It was a deliberate word. I think it riled some people up, and I think that's okay. It was an interesting thing to go through controversy. Actually, we put it out as a hypothesis. There was nowhere that we said people should deliberately be infected. And I think it just got some people to be able to yell and then they calm down.
So, and you talked a little bit, I saw your interview with Z-Dog.
Yeah.
In October, and I kind of brought this up in one of my recent podcasts about, you talked about how people, they just kind of go into their camps and there's not a lot of discussion among people. I mean, it almost seems like this is a lot of the science is being kind of led by fear, where we're not really allowing honest debate or anything like that. How do you feel that was created? I mean, how did we get to this spot?
Yeah, I mean, I have never seen anything like it. I think what happened and how we got to this spot is, you know, it started with Trump, but it went beyond President Trump. I mean, what happened is that we became profoundly politicized about a virus. And so even words like immunity, because people around him were talking about herd immunity, even the word immunity got connotations that were politicized. The word mask became politicized. It was profound. And it wasn't even that anyone stopped and paid attention to the science. You were either on this camp, which meant that you had to be fearful, lock down, stay in your house, sort of ignore the fact that, like, most of the poor can't do that. And you can't do that if you're socioeconomically deprived and you have, like, day-to-day bread earning to do, and that healthcare workers can't do that, and a whole bunch of people can't stay at home. But it became, the polemics almost became, I think, divided along the lines of privileged, if you were privileged enough to be able to stay at home or not. And it was fascinating, and it remains fascinating, and it's really disturbing. And I brought up in that interview this kind of 1832 Paris polemics argument with the cholera epidemic, which is that either it was in the miasma or it was in the sewage. And it actually was in the sewage. But the point was that there were these two camps, and there was the hygienist camp and there was the miasma camp. And you either closed down the poor areas because their sewage was spreading this, or you made everyone stay at home. But of course, the poor can't stay home because they had to do all our essential functions. And either way, the poor lost. And so we were not, the scientists were not listening to each other. And I think this is a new pandemic. There's lots that's being discovered. We know a lot more, but we still don't know everything. And people want to yell. And people want, and their egos are coming into it. And maybe they didn't think about this hypothesis before, and that makes them mad. And it's honestly, it has become a polemic debate. People are yelling. This is a ridiculous way to do science. It's ridiculous for healthcare professionals to yell at people about Thanksgiving, as opposed to let's start with you're really lonely and you haven't seen your family. Now let's think about how to mitigate that risk. Instead of anyone who goes to see grandma wants to kill grandma, we're using really just language that is just profoundly unhelpful in public health messaging. And the fact that everyone said stay home and it was a busy time of travel just speaks to we have lost the trust of the public when you do not message effectively and you do not message kindly and you don't message with sympathy. And this mask argument has become the same thing. Stay at home, don't wear a mask. And who is this person over here saying that you may be more safe if you go out with a mask? That is, you're giving the public too much confidence, and it blew up.
Now, you're an HIV researcher, so you know the consequences of stigmatizing behaviors. I mean, I feel like we've created this stigma around coronavirus. Could you briefly speak to, I mean, how effective is stigmatizing behaviors and HIV patients? I mean, how does that play out in a public health sense?
I think that's exactly why I became so interested in this, is that I am an HIV doctor. And I have never heard a single HIV person say, wear a condom, stupid, or wear an F condom. But I have heard lots of public health messengers say, wear a stupid mask. So the point being is that harm reduction messaging, the idea that you meet people where they are, that they may choose to take risks for a whole variety of reasons, not because they're an awful person, but because the pathogen is one aspect of their holistic life. And being around others and not using a condom or an intimate conversation or using drugs is another aspect of their life. And how do you message so that you give people effective public health messaging, meeting them where they are, which may be to take risks? And stigmatizing people and calling them words, and look at these words, good, safe, low risk, good, coming back to good, like using the word good. Have you been good this vacation so that you can send your child back to school? These are words that imply that some people are good and will do everything right, and some people are going to be stigmatized for taking risks, maybe around getting COVID, because they have to go out and work, or because they want to see their mother, or because they want to go visit a sick friend. So it is amazingly ineffective to stigmatize as a public health message. And what I've been fascinated by, and I know this may seem unfair, but I feel that healthcare professionals, people who actually see patients, are gently messaging and understand because they're talking to people every day, and PhD epidemiologists who are sitting in their houses, which are often nice houses, and looking at a Zoom call, may not know how to address as effectively the public health messaging around COVID-19 prevention, because 9 months and counting and saying just stay in your houses is simply not taking people's holistic needs into account.
Do you think, I had a teacher on my show last episode, and she was talking about the burden that schools have in public health. Do you think that part of that messaging of a PhD researcher in their home and someone who's actually out in the world, do you think that there's this disconnect where there's a lot of public health burden and problems that a lot of these policymakers don't fully recognize? And they say, well, you can stay home, but...
Yes, yes. I think that is actually fundamentally the difference here between a PhD and an MD, or a PhD and a healthcare professional who goes and sees patients messaging around this, that they are actually talking to people every day who have true mental health, loneliness, depression problems. Their other healthcare needs have been ignored. They're scared to come to the clinic because they are scared about this COVID messaging. We shut down restaurants and so forth. So they're like, well, wait, can I still come in for my procedure? Because I really can't see, but maybe this means we're on total shutdown. It is that you have to be around other people who have other concerns besides COVID to, I think, effectively message in a public health way. And so I think it's very ineffective to say, let's lock down right now. in November, or no one should go and see their relatives, it's clearly ineffective to say that. Instead, how do we meet? Yes, we are in a surge. Yes, COVID is terrible. Yes, people died from COVID. Yes, we did a bad job in this country. We need people to actually hold out a little bit longer until we get the vaccines, with masks and distancing and staying in their bubbles as much as they can. We need things from the public. And so how do you effectively and holistically message that, with the idea that there's light at the end of the tunnel, this is not forever? And how do you do that in a realistic way that makes them relate to you? Like, I have to go to work every day, do you? Yes, I'm a healthcare worker. I have to go to work every day. I go to the clinic every day. So I think we're going to look back on this time and we're going to say who was effective in messaging and who is not. And we didn't do it right. We didn't do it right. The United States didn't do it right. I don't think we can purely blame former President Trump. I don't think we can. I think we can blame him for a lot, but the backlash against him and the backlash of doom and gloom and fear. And if he said open schools, then we better keep the schools closed. Oh, wait, that really affects the poor more, but let's ignore that. He said it, so that he must be wrong. Yeah. It is partially the backlash and our extreme position. There can't be any immunity to SARS-CoV-2. Oh, wait, there is immunity to SARS-CoV-2. But for the first 6 months, we're going to say there's no immunity to a virus, even though there's always been immunity to viruses. These extreme positions that we took on the left absolutely messed up this response. And boy, I'm so interested to see the history book of this time that can't blame just one person. We have to blame both sides.
So hypothetically, 5 years from now, you're teaching your students about the 2020 pandemic. What would be the brief description of this is the good, this is the bad, this is what we can learn from this? What would you hope that those students learn from that lesson?
I hope that they would learn that we politicized a pandemic. Trump politicized it. He ignored science, but the scientists were so angry at him for ignoring science that they used really harsh doom and gloom, terrible messaging that paid zero attention to the needs of the poor. And we made everything about COVID because we wanted to get Trump out. And we did get Trump out, actually. He did get voted out. But even so, we're continuing a doom and gloom, scary, miserable messaging platform until he actually physically leaves. And we are not having nuanced discussions about do you get immunity after mild infection? What do masks do? Can they give you a mild infection? Can they give you and help build up immunity? And we were so busy panicking and screaming that we did not stop and look in a nuanced way at the science and put it all together to have an effective harm reduction approach to getting the American populace to comply with what was needed to lower the rates of viral transmission to the point that we didn't have to have these surges and deaths. We didn't do it right. And I will teach in 5 years, and I hope I can actually, that HIV, we should have turned to our HIV colleagues. We should have turned to people who think about harm reduction. We should have turned to people who think about effective ways to talk to someone who is miserable, and it's not because they're crazy. They're miserable because they're so lonely. We didn't turn to those social behavioralists and HIV people to learn how to message. And we also, scientists also messed up this response.
So you've talked a couple times about the doom and gloom and this overdone reaction to Trump, right? You did a lot of work as infectious disease. You know how disease spread. I have an idea where maybe our mental health, our anxiety, and our depression almost spreads just like a virus, where one person starts freaking out and then it affects another person and then it affects another person. Kind of say, would you agree with that approach of this is kind of what happened? All of a sudden, we're all yelling and screaming and flipping out.
Yes. I mean, I think that's an incredibly interesting idea, because when I talked to ZDog MD, I talked about the stratas of fear, which is this idea that I think we are all deciding who we can be around based on the things that we used to think we could be around them. Like, you like the outdoors, or you like books, or you like movies, or we have similar interests, we have similar politics, and suddenly a new incredibly bizarre characteristic has come into it. You are overly fearful, or you're not fearful of the virus. And because you're so fearful of the virus, I can't actually be around you, because your over fear is scaring me. And because you're so not fearful of the virus on the other end, I'm not comfortable around you. All of that has now played into our characteristics of what makes us feel close to someone. And spreading fear, and that anxiety and fear, that spreads like a virus. So this is not a radioactive virus. This is actually, there's no radioactive virus in the world except in the movies. This is a respiratory-led virus. And there are very clean and simple ways to prevent people from getting spread from the nose and mouth to the other person. And one of them is masking, and one of them is distancing, and one of them is hand hygiene, and one of them is ventilation. And those are called non-pharmaceutical interventions, and they all work. I have been around old people, parents, other people where all four are employed, and no one has gotten sick, because this is actually a respiratory virus, and we know how it spread. And so you can, but if you put that fear into it, that if you're even just around someone, it's going to happen. If you pass someone on the street, it's going to happen. You're going to get COVID. You better keep on testing. If you just leave your home, you're going to get COVID. That's not reasonable messaging. That's not accurate. It doesn't spread, through tiny, like the sun. It doesn't. It spreads through the nose and mouth. It's a respiratory virus. And so we also wanted to message through fear, because we think that's a way to wrangle the population to do what we want. And so if you use fear, people will stay in their homes and not leave. They will also become profoundly lonely. They will become very depressed. There will be increased rates of suicide. There'll become increased rates of self-harm. But we'll deal with that later. That's not right. That is not how people live. And so we wanted to use extreme fear, because Trump was using no fear at all. His idea was that this wasn't really real, or what is this? Who cares? I got it and it didn't matter. I'm fine. So that we took an extreme position in this country of fear, and we alienated people. We alienated people who wanted to just like go safely and see their family over Thanksgiving. We lost public trust when we said that masks don't work. I think it's losing trust to say, I think it helps you lose trust to say, well, yeah, masks work, but they won't mitigate disease severity, and you're just getting too comfortable with masks. So let's just say masks don't work. I mean, that's not a good message. Like, I think masks work. And so I think we wanted to use extreme positions because of the how extreme we found Trump, and he is an extreme example. And we did it horribly. And epicenter pandemic since March 26th. We're the only place that's doing this horribly. We cannot argue. We cannot say it's still all Trump's fault, right? Like, we can't keep on doing that. And so I think we turned people off by talking about lockdowns so much. We turned people off about not expressing sympathy for the loss of their businesses. We turned people off by, it wasn't just stimulus packages. We turned people off who had to go out in the world by using the phrase stay at home. We did it wrong.
I agree. I think that we took political tools such as fear that'll help you win an election, and we applied it to something that's an evolving process as science. And very quickly, as you said, people went into camps, and we just shut down any debate.
Talk
about things at all.
Right. And we're still doing it in the sense that, like, when Biden got elected, he had this task force, and then one member of the task force immediately came out and said, we better lock down the whole country to 4 to 6 weeks. And then that totally alienated like 70 million people who still didn't even think that maybe they weren't even sure Biden won. And then everyone else on the Biden task force came out and said, no, we didn't mean that. That wasn't the message that we were conveying. And that turned people off because they were like, hey, what about our businesses? Hey, what about our, you just let me open my, like, with lots and lots of precautions, you just let me open my outside restaurant. Now I can't open my outside restaurant, even outside. So we're continuing the extreme, right? Like, we're not actually talking about, I mean, California is a very good example, actually. Gavin Newsom just said today he may go back to shelter in place for some counties, which he did in March. That will turn people off because we have all these other mitigation ways in place. He's already shut down many businesses. See how that works. But the phrase shelter in place or going back to March is very hard for people. And there are people like who want to recall him. We're just doing this wrong. We're doing this wrong. The only way I can think of getting out of this is to give everyone a vaccine and ignore that we did public health completely wrong. And we led to all these deaths and we led to all this alienation, and then write a history book about how only the vaccine got us out of it. Cause I don't think our public health measures did.
I think quite honestly, if you look at it from a historical sense, for a lot of leaders in politics and in public health, this was their World War II. I mean, this was their big thing. And it makes me question, I was talking to a number of my colleagues, it makes me question, are we putting the right leaders in place? If this comes along, and I know you mentioned Gavin Newsom, and I know that there's a controversy, I don't completely understand it, but he went out to eat with his friends.
Yeah, right. Because he was acknowledging his own humanity, right? Like, he wanted to actually like see his friends and family. Yep. And he was acknowledging his own humanity, but then he was also telling people to stay at home.
Yeah. I mean, it almost makes me question whether or not we have the right leaders in positions for crises such as this.
Yes, it's a great point.
So I know you're running out of time. I know you have lots going on. We'll end with an easy, well...
You don't ask easy questions.
Pardon?
You don't ask easy questions.
I'm sorry. I prepared so much for this. I was so, like I said, first person with the Wikipedia page. So a non-COVID question. It's a tough one, though. It's a tough one. Three things that make you a good doctor. Three things that you could improve on. These are tough questions.
Yes.
How about two?
Two things that are good and two things that I can improve on. So I will say that two things that I can, I actually really do like this hypothesis about the viral load or dose leading to less severity of disease. And I like that I and others thought about it, and I want to explore that more through other viruses. So I like that came out of this year. I also like that I wrote a paper recently that I hope will get published about harm reduction messaging and everything we're talking about now, that never used the phrase stupid or moron or COVID idiot or I'm not going to treat you if you don't wear a mask. These are unacceptable language by healthcare professionals. And so I'm proud of that, though it hasn't been published yet. And then in terms of things to improve, to be honest, I actually think that people's fear of COVID-19 is partially a spiritual crisis. And it's a crisis of not understanding that mortality is 100% for all of us. And being kinder, I think I need to be kinder about people's fear and anxiety about COVID-19. I feel like if I could just say, like, it's not radioactive, then people would be less scared. And I don't think that's fair. I think that I have also had a little bit of a very judgmental way of being around people who are too fearful, because I'm like, I know that you can't catch it this way. And so you can't catch it from surfaces. So stop disinfecting. I think I have to be more compassionate about whatever this did to us. Like, something reached in and took something primal about our fear of death. And that's what COVID-19 did, even though many of us will not get COVID-19, nor will we die from it. And then these public health practitioners took that primal fear of death and they exploited it. And I also need to be kinder and more compassionate about that profound fear of mortality, and figure out now going forward in my patient practice, what is it that triggers you that doesn't seem like it triggers me? Like, I'm not scared of this, or you're not scared of that, you're not scared of that. And meeting people where they are with fear, even if it's phobia fear. So I think this is going to make me kinder doctor. I hope it will, because I understand that people are fearful.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry that they're fearful, and I'm sorry that we exploited it.
Well, I thank you so much for doing this. Do you have anything else you want to add? Anything at all you want to add?
I mean, I think it was what you mentioned in the, when you first reached out to me about variolation. I think it's worth saying it, like what your kind of historical, history, if you just want to bring that up, because I actually thought that was really important, that this was a way to get, when I use the word variolation, I used it deliberately. And if you could just say what you were telling me on the email, which is the history behind that, because it was a real way to get.
Yeah, absolutely. So the reason I got so interested in smallpox was that people don't think of it. They think of the Black Death, and for some reason, smallpox doesn't burn a memory in as many of us as things like the Black Death do. Maybe it's the costumes and the uniforms in the Black Death or whatever. I have no idea. But smallpox killed millions and millions and millions of people, and it was eradicated within the lifetime of many people, you know, in the 1970s. And we forget this. And what I loved about the story of smallpox was, first, there was a woman, Lady Montague, who brought this idea from Istanbul to England. And I think that medicine suffers from this a lot of times, where you have established ideas and you have established people who say, no, you're a woman, we're not going to bring this in. Oh, that's a foreign idea, we're not going to bring this in. And maybe it's not as blunt as that now, but I think with even H. pylori, the researchers were from Perth, Australia. They weren't seen as rock stars, and therefore their research didn't get in there, right? And I think that that's really important. But Lady Montague, what they did is they would take someone with a low case of smallpox, and they would scratch the pus into their arm, giving them a low viral load, and hence they would decrease the mortality. And it was kind of a primitive vaccine. So when you mentioned virulation, you were spot on. I mean, it was perfect. It was an imperfect method of trying to create immunity without a viable vaccine.
And I think while you're getting to the vaccine.
Because
the point was that not everyone can be inside their house, and not everyone has a house. I mean, that was actually the point, that like that if you're going to get it, get a mild case and get immunity. Don't go out and get deliberately infected, but keep yourself safe.
Yeah. And I think you were spot on with that. So, and I thought that your connection between viral load, I mean, it seemed that there was a voice of reason there, because a lot of the debate that we have going on right now is so amped up and driven by fear that you sit there and say, wait a second, HIV has a viral load that you have to get before you get in.
Yes, you do.
Measles,
hepatitis C,
whatever it may be. So why is this disease somehow different? I mean, it seemed very difficult to
because of fear, because people want people to stay fearful. So they think that they'll drive people in their houses, and they have driven many people in their houses, and they've driven many other people to anger.
Yeah. And I think that sadly, some of these public health consequences will not be recognized for 5-10 years. And we'll look back. I mean, in the clinics, STD rates are skyrocketing. Domestic abuse is skyrocketing.
Yes.
And I, you know, A1Cs are out of control. Blood pressure is out of control. And I'm sitting there saying, like, oh, we went too far.
We went too far. We'll write that book in 5 years together. Do you want to write that with me?
Let's do it.
So we'll stay in touch and do that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
You have a coffee mug coming. So check them out.
That is very nice of you. Thank you very much. Coffee is like my favorite thing. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
I wanted to end the show with a little bit of a different perspective on the COVID-19 pandemic. A working paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research recently found that news coverage of the pandemic in the United States is much more negative when compared to coverage in other nations. For example, there are more stories related to Donald Trump's handling of the pandemic, as well as hydroxychloroquine, than all the positive stories related to treatment advances, as well as advances related to the vaccines. That being said, I did want to talk about some positive news. We are getting better at treating COVID-19, and the death rate has dropped over the summer and continues to drop despite the fact that there are more and more cases. Examples of better treatments include a move away from invasive ventilators, as well as the use of dexamethasone to treat patients. There is also a study out of the CDC that looked at the number of asymptomatic carriers. What they found is up to 20% of individuals who are positive for COVID-19 may not demonstrate symptoms. Now, these individuals will continue to potentially spread the disease, but if we take that 20% of individuals and use that in our statistics, the death rate from COVID-19 would be lower than it is today. Finally, I want to emphasize the recent developments related to the vaccines. Both the Moderna as well as the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccines showed very promising results, and we should see these vaccines within the next month. It also should be recognized that the silver lining related to the development of these vaccines is that much of the information gleaned from the development of them can be applied to other illnesses such as cancer. BioNTech, for example, was a cancer research company before it became a vaccine company. That's all for today. My name is Jason Meckenbier, and this is Better Worse of the Same. You can follow us on Google Podcasts as well as Spotify.